Well, good evening. It's Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our live stream, which is on the 4th of August, 2020. Great to have you on. And thank you very much for taking time out and spending it with me. Of course, those of you in Melbourne, you haven't got much choice, really. You're locked in now. So maybe we'll get more Melbourne people on the stream tonight. But anyway, wherever you're coming from, where you're signing in from, welcome. We've already got a few overseas people as well. Great to see you all on the stream tonight. Very important conversation this evening because, of course, this is real-time information that we're sharing with you. No one has seen this information other than yourselves, so you're the first to grab it. And as normal, I'm just going to go through with a few opening remarks before I get going. And I'm not going to be looking at the chat for a few moments. So if you have questions or if you have observations you'd like me to respond to, hang off until I've done the first part of the show. So here we go. Just quickly, what we're going to do is go through this introduction, the house rules about our models, some key slides, then the Q&A section. The Q&A will be the main part, of course. Typically, it goes for about an hour and a half in total, and then we sign off and hopefully move on. That's the theory. And in terms of house rules, I just always say this, it's really important that you understand this isn't financial advice. I'm doing a lot of modelling and analysis, but I don't know your personal circumstances. If you need financial advice, go talk to a financial advisor. I'm not providing that here tonight, just my general impressions about what's going on. Please play nice in the chat room. Plexus is doing his thing. Thanks, Plexus. No racial slurs, please. And, you know, we have the facility to turn people off if they get a bit antsy. So no need for that. Plenty of conversations in the chat room. I do encourage you to share views with other people on the chat. That's part of what this is about. This community is really important to me. And part of that is allowing the community to be able to actually share views with each other. And so feel free to do that. This is at the 4th of August 2020, so if you're watching this down the track, you'll know whether I was right or whether I was wrong, because I'm making some predictions again tonight. And please use @WalkTheWorld if you want to get my attention on the chat. There are always lots of conversations going on. I never have a chance to look at all of them, so that's just a thing to remember, @WalkTheWorld. Super Chat has been enabled. If you'd like to make a contribution to support us, you can do that via Super Chat, or if you want to get your question noticed, again, you can use Super Chat. And that's make sure that your question comes to the top of the list. Now, just quickly, for those new on the stream, we use our core market model to talk about our data. The core market model is fundamentally a set of surveys that we run for households and SMEs, 52,000 in a year. It rolls over every week, every month. So we're getting new information in. So the data that, you know, I'll be sharing with you shortly came in this Tuesday. So it's very, very, very current. It's probably the most current set of data that's out there. And of course, that feeds our blog, that feeds our client work, and also the YouTube. And we can slice and dice the data all sorts of different ways, as you know. And we'll be doing some of that this evening, looking specifically at the various stress elements. And again, we're pretty sophisticated. Now, we've added more elements into the model. We've added a new set of functionality, which I'll talk about, not necessarily tonight, but down the track, where I start now to look at price projections at a more granular level. So we might touch on that a bit later. Now, let's firstly go to the RBA, because the RBA did make a brief statement today. I have to say it wasn't particularly illuminating, because basically they didn't change the rate. But what they did say was that the situation, the Australian economy is going through a very difficult period. Biggest contraction since the 1930s. Well, we sort of knew that, I guess. This recovery is going to be uneven and bumpy, and the thing about Victoria is it's going to have a major effect on the Victorian economy. Given the uncertainties, the overall outlook, the board considered a range of scenarios it's meeting. The baseline, though, is a fall of 6% this year. Now, that's lower than what they were talking about previously, and then growth by 5% over the following year. Good luck with that is what I'd say based on what I'm seeing, but that's what they're saying. And they say that the unemployment rate is going to rise to about 10% later in 2020 due to further job losses, particularly from Victoria. And remember that the last projection was 9.25, so that's gone up because of what's happening in Victoria. There's about 250,000 people now out of work currently question is how that translates ahead. And they're talking about in the following couple of years, the unemployment rate is expected to decline gradually to about 7%. But of course, that's all predicated on what happens with the virus and therefore very uncertain. And then they talked about CPI, which of course dropped 0.3%. Now, that I did a show with John Adams the other day saying that CPI number is pretty nutty. The true CPI is up 0.1% or something like that. So it was actually not as negative. But they're talking about spare capacity in the economy. They're talking about inflation. It's going to sit between 1% and 1.5% for the next couple of years. In other words, the RBA is not maintaining 2% to 3% inflation, which of course is its main reason for being there. So it continues to underperform. I have to say that if I was that degree of underperforming when I was in work, I probably would be out of a job. But no, the RBA is still there. Now, in terms of data, APRA published some information today relating to deferred loans, and they basically made the point that there's 274 billions of loans granted temporary repayment deferrals, which is around 10% of total loans outstanding. That's a big number. Housing loans were $195 billion, which is 11% of the $1.8 trillion. Although small business loans at $55 billion has a higher incidence of repayment deferrals, 17% of $321 billion. And there was a small amount of good news in terms of people exiting from repayment deferrals, from $2 billion to $18 billion in June. And the majority of those loans have returned to performing status. But overall, if you look at this this chart here, you can see that we've got a huge amount of issues. And that translates, by my calculation, to around 390,000 households and around 496,000 mortgage loans. Investors continue to comprise 34% of housing deferrals, with interest only at 14%, and loans with an LVR of over 90 at 8%. And interestingly, the LVR above 90 are the ones that are most likely not to return, they said, to normal status. Now, also today, they released the latest information relating to super, and we've now got $29.4 billion released since inception of the scheme. Another $1.4 billion was released this time around. Average payment, $7,705 overall, but $8,547. And, of course, a lot of young people are now running down their superannuation to zero. And I would make the point that if you do a quick calculation here on the superannuation amount, the total amount drawn from the superannuation system into the economy is actually probably now higher than the JobKeeper payments so far. So essentially, it's the private sector savings from individual super funds that are actually supporting the economy. One reason why retail is a bit stronger, I'll talk about that in a second. And in fact, you could argue that this is a really bad policy. I personally think it was nutty to start with. But the more I see it going on, the more I'm convinced that it's going to end in tears. So many people will have no superannuation as a result of that. Now, we can also then look at the household confidence data. This came out today from Roy Morgan. It was down 0.4%. And it's continued down. That's now 6 weeks straight. There was mixed. There were a few issues with current finances declining by 0.6, while future finances gained a little bit. And, you know, there's a little bit of a time to buy a household item that moved up slightly after falls for 5 straight weeks. But look, this confidence level is very, very low, and that's a big deal. And of course, the Melbourne situation is going to make it worse, because this data was released before the Melbourne lockdown was announced. Unemployment continues to be very high. The ABS was 7.4%. That's understating the true position. Roy Morgan thinks unemployment is 12.5%. But more importantly, if you take unemployment and underemployment, Roy Morgan says it's 23%, which is down from 27%. But that's more than 20%, one in five people out of work or underemployed. And what they've said is an additional 1.5 million Australians were underemployed, 10.5% of the workforce, up 92,000 a month ago. And there was a drop in unemployment because of the fact that a few more people came to work. But 3.8 million households, 3.8 million, just remember that number, 3.8 million households, 23% of the workforce, were either unemployed or underemployed, which was a slight improvement, 171,000, but still very, very worrying, very significant. Now, retail turnover was also announced today, and in fact, there was a bit of a blip up, 2.7%. Nothing like the previous month. Of course, we've had wild retail because we've seen people growing and changing their particular spending patterns. So cafes, restaurants and takeaway food services was up. Of course, they were very low previously. Clothing, footwear and personal accessories were up. But department stores were down and household goods retailing were down. And across the states, some significant variations. New South Wales, Victoria, both up. Northern Territory down. And ACT was up as well. So if you look at it in total value terms, it's actually down more than 3% in the quarter. So that's based on prices rather than actually just turnover. And what that tells you is that retail is still pretty sick. And the final point there is online was actually quite interesting. 15% of non-food, about 4% of food, and therefore the total is sitting just under 10%. So it was higher, but of course you look here, it's much higher than previously. So online is still very much dominating compared with where it used to be. Now, I want to remind you next about this stimulus cliff, because the fact of the matter is that currently we've got significant investment from the government in terms of fiscal stimulus and other policy stimulus from loan deferrals and business transfers and job seeker and job keeper. But this is how it plays out ahead. So there is already a cliff in the fourth quarter and into the first quarter 21. Now, that will change, I think, because of Victoria and what's happening there. But nevertheless, this is something to bear in mind. Things are going to get tighter. Now, Alan Kohler reported a Morgan Stanley survey that said that 55% of them of households had received some form of income support. 8% were using the bank's repayment holiday, 22% were using JobKeeper, 15% on JobSeeker, 24% had received more one or more of the 750 one-off payments, and 11% had taken out early super. 15% of those surveyed with a mortgage are on the dole, he said, which is currently $557.85. And he's positing that they can probably make their repayments, but it's going to come down, of course, based on what they announced recently. And his view is this is going to get very serious quite soon. Meanwhile, JobKeeper gets reduced to zero in March, and there are no more one-off 750 payments planned. Mortgage repayment holidays are due to end in January, and two super withdrawals of 10,000 each are it. So he says, to sum up, the survey suggests that 3.3 million people, or 55% of Australia's 6 million mortgage, need to find decent jobs within 6 months, or they will default. And in a way, my mortgage stress data is underscoring that these early warning signs are definitely in the system. And also others are calling the market lower, property market particularly. SQM, Louis Christopher said, housing market was falling as we speak. We'll see an increasing 3 or 4 months that people will need to sell either because they have been prompted by their bank or they have lost their job and don't want to be prompted. And that's the point. The bank's now ringing people up and basically asking whether they are going to get their income back. And if not, there are conversations going on which will run through to January. So we're going to see, I think, more forced sales coming through. And he said that expected prices to fall over the next months and said October could be the crunch time. I tend to agree with that. I think October, November will be it. And Shane Oliver at AMP says we're in the twilight zone of the government support and bank payment holidays, protecting the market. He expects ongoing weaknesses and falling prices as higher unemployment, lower rent and immigration impact on the market. So there you go. More people saying the same thing. And now this is quite astonishing, even Peter Switzer has gone bearish. On a recent Sky News report, he actually warned that Melbourne's lockdown, quote, will see house prices fall faster than they currently are. You have to expect consumer confidence and business confidence will fall. Therefore, business investment falls and then house prices will fall faster than they currently are. Specifically Victoria, because it's difficult to sell if you can't get people to go to open house. And the fear factor is getting bigger. The last 5 weeks in a row, confidence has fallen and is all linked to the lockdown, putting a question mark over the rest of the economy. There you go. Now, Mr. Switzer, of course, has tended to be very bullish on property, so it'll be interesting to see whether he maintains his bearish stance now. CoreLogic's latest data showed that there were some significant drops in various parts of the portfolio. Obviously, annualized, Sydney and Melbourne are still up. But of course, over the quarter, Melbourne's down 3.2, Sydney 2.1 on average. Remember, these are averages. These don't tell you the full story. But I wanted to highlight more the fact that even CoreLogic is now talking about urgent sales are likely to become more common as we approach, you know, the milestones that we mentioned before, and also concerns about the second wave of the virus. And as stimulus measures wind down and borrowers take a repayment holiday phase, it's logical to expect a rise in distressed properties coming onto the market. And of course, they said the extent depends, but on average, they're calling 10% down on prices, but probably higher drops, larger drops in Sydney and Melbourne. And listings are up, and weirdly up, actually. So there was a report in the Financial Review that new homes listings surged 21% in Sydney during July. That's based on SQM data, which shows you that if you look at the monthly change, 8.7% and 5.9% in Sydney and Melbourne, respectively. And from Cookie Boy, he sent through some listings data. So Domain has 241,000 listings and 31,000 under offer. Realestate.com.au has 234,000 listings and 31,000 under offer. These are big numbers at this time of year. And I think this shows that people are wanting to get out. It's consistent with my surveys, by the way, as well, which shows that people want to get out if they can. Okay, so now into my mortgage stress. So now this is the critical chart to share with you. And so I've rerun the data, and the number moved up to 40.2% of households in mortgage stress in July, up from 39 a month earlier. Very big jump, much actually higher than I expected. And that's a combination of what was happening in Victoria and the fact that in other states, the jobs that were expected to come back haven't come back. This is a big deal. So we've got now very, very significant mortgage stress. I still estimate a higher number into September, 40.8, or that probably it'll go higher than that. Now, if you want to try and understand what this is all about, remember what I'm talking about here is cash flow. I'm talking about money in, money out. I'm talking about households who are struggling because they're having to pay out more than they are actually receiving. And this is the latest data for mortgage stress by states, and it's sorted by big red arrow here to show where it's sorted by. So you can see that in Tasmania, 48% of households are in stress, 44% in Northern Territories, 43.4% in Victoria, then it goes Western Australia, New South Wales at 38%. And I just make the point that Tasmania and Northern Territories did improve slightly. That's because they've got the COVID sort of locked down a little bit at the moment, but every other state actually increased. And in fact, if I show you the previous month, that's actually the previous month there. So you can see Victoria, 406,000 in June, and now 430,000 in July. So that's a significant increase. And if you look in New South Wales, it was 408,000, and it's gone up to 426,000. So we're seeing significant rises in our major states, to the point where you've got 40.2% of mortgages in mortgage stress, and that equates to 1.517 million, or 1,517,807 estimated households, and more than 100,000 risking default. That was below 100,000 last time. So this is a big deal because it's building. Now, if you then look at it by segments, and again, we use our standard DFA segments, you can see here that, again, it's sorted by percentage in stress. Young growing families, as always, right at the top of the list. Then the battling urban, the disadvantaged fringe. Then the multicultural. And down the bottom, we've got wealthy seniors, young affluent. But again, we've got one third of exclusive professionals, the top end of the market, the top 2 or 3% by income and socio demographics, who are really under the gun. Many of them are really struggling, and they have the biggest losses coming through simply because they're multiple mortgages and multiply leveraged. So this is quite a significant issue. And within the first-time buyer cohort, a lot of them are in young growing families, and some others are in the young affluents. And so quite often you'll see that it's those first-time buyers who bought relatively recently are also finding it quite difficult to maintain their mortgage repayments. And here are the top postcodes. It's a little bit small. I apologize for that. I will try and just enlarge it if I can. Let me see whether I can. Hang on. Go there. Can I make it bigger? Yes, I can. There you go. Okay. So you can see there that it's postcode 3810 Pakenham, who has the highest. Then we go to Western Australia 6030 Curtin. Then we go back to Melbourne, so Derrimut Point Cook 3030. Then a 3064 Craigieburn, Mickenham, Rocks Park. And so it goes on. Hoppers Crossing, another Melbourne one there, 3029. We should just mention we've also got Sydney there, 2770. Then we go up to Brisbane, Ipswich and the area around there, very significant and important. Back to Sydney, Stannett Gardens, Park Lee. Down to Melbourne again, Cannons Creek. These are all the sort of postcodes that you would perhaps expect to see. And the point to make here is that if you look at the in total counts, in fact, the stress count is actually quite significant here, insofar that you've got 6,655 in Pakenham and around that area, 6,644 in Curtin, and so you've got more than 6,000 in some of these. Now, if you look in the percentage term, 67%, 74%, 32%. So these are big numbers, big locations, and a lot of these are actually outer urban fringe, a lot of construction over the last few years, highly developed, small plots, quite often on properties that really probably have been overbuilt, very large mortgages, and actually above average incomes quite often as well. So, but that's where the hot spots actually are. Now, I'll do some more mapping of this soon, but there you go. That's the story there. Now, let's move on to rental stress. This is another dimension, of course, that I look at my surveys. And we've got 34.5% in rental stress across the country, 1.787 million. New South Wales leads rental stress at 48.4, then Victoria. And so it goes down. And large number of people, 721,000 in New South Wales, 472,000 in Victoria. By segment, similar story, young affluence, multicultural, near the top there, maybe not too surprising. That would include quite a few students from overseas who are here and not getting perhaps the income that they would have expected from the working part-time and those sorts of things. I want to highlight again that even some exclusive professionals, young growing families, are actually also in rental stress. So 34.5%. And if you look at the postcodes, postcode 3000 Melbourne with 12,900 is actually the postcode with the largest amount of stress around the country. And then Campbelltown, 9,000, that's in New South Wales, 2560. Then West Gosford up in north of Sydney, in the Central Coast, 2250 at 8,700. And then Jervis Bay, Mount Druitt, Liverpool, Wentworth, Blacktown, Surfers Paradise, Parramatta, the entrance, and so it goes on. These are areas with lots and lots of people with rental issues. I'll show you that Wollongong is there, just 2500 further down the list, and so it goes on. So a lot of these are in Sydney, Melbourne, but you can see also Queensland's showing there as well. One or two further down the list in other locations too, but a lot of it is Sydney, Melbourne. And finally, property investor stress. Now, whilst I was looking at just cash flow on the first two, this is actually looking at it from the point of view of are property investors and where they're living, not necessarily where their property is, are they able to service their mortgage? Have they got a vacant property? Are they actually trying to sell? Or do they have cash flow issues with servicing? And I put all that information, and we've now got 25.2% of property investors, 25.2% who are struggling. And of that, we've got 34.4% of those in New South Wales. This is where they're living, not necessarily where their property is. 31.4% in the ACT. Some were a bit surprised there that the ACT is so high, but of course a lot of people are living in the ACT but are renting in other locations, renting probably out in other locations. Then Victoria, 24.4. And of that, you've got what I call severe stressed investors, which are the ones that are severely under pressure, and these are the ones that are most likely to be looking to sell. So I keep saying there's a significant build-up of people looking to sell their properties, and we're seeing this coming through now in spades in our data. And just to give you a bottom-line number, there's more than 3.2 million properties for rent in Australia. There's more than 2.8 million owners of rental property. There's more than 832,000 stressed out of that pool, and 128,000 are severe stress out of that stressed pool, 25.2%. And looking at it by segment, again, sorted by percentage, young affluents are the most stressed. Maybe not surprising. So people perhaps buy into investment property without necessarily knowing what they're doing. And you know, they've got money, but they don't know what they're doing. And then you've got exclusive professionals. Now, they'll have multiple properties. Both these two groups, the young affluent and exclusive professionals, often end up with multiple properties. And then we've got multicultural, and then we've got mature stable. And so it goes down. Young growing families, not so much, compared with the others, of course, because they're mostly buying their own property rather than for investment purposes. And then here are some postcodes. Now, spot the common theme. The most stressed postcode where property investors are living is Melbourne, 3,000, with more than 4,000 stressed investors. And then 4217 up in Queensland at more than 4,000. Surry Hills, 2010, South Yarra, 3141, Bundaberg, 4670, Wentworthville, 2145. And look at this, Mandurah in Western Australia with 3,444 stressed investors. Now remember, Mandurah is my standout postcode insofar I've been watching mortgage stress build, property prices in Mandurah down 38%. And there are massive social issues and massive attempts to try and sell property. And so this is a warning of what can happen, I think. Then we go to Sydney, Paradise Point, Queensland, Southport, Wollongong, Harvey Bay, Rushcoppers Bay, Lane Cove, and so it goes on. Then down to Campbelltown. So you can see that some of these areas are close in to the centre of town, but others are further out. And these numbers are very significant. And I just want to highlight also that Melbourne 3000 has 1,576 stressed investors, severe stressed investors, which means that they are much more likely to want to sell. So I'm expecting more downward pressure on property prices in Melbourne 3000 as a result of that. And 78.5% of investors in that postcode are stressed. Now, of course, we don't know precisely where they hold their investment property. Some will hold it in 3000, some will hold it elsewhere, but this is a big deal. All right, and then finally, the scenarios. And you will know that I've been updating my scenarios quite regularly. The thing about the scenarios is that it drives out of the back of the model. So this is effectively a series of mathematical algorithms. It's not just me sort of picking a number. And, you know, each time we run the model, we update the scenario. So I'm just going to go through and give you the latest and greatest, and then I'll start answering some questions. So the first thing to say about the scenarios is that it's a way of understanding different futures and trying to get a sense of how things are laying out. This is not a prediction. It's just a relativity in terms of where I think the weight of evidence lays at the moment. And we run the scenarios forward from today. And I guess we also have to say that it includes, of course, the fact that COVID is in play, as it were. So the RBA baseline is still sitting, you know, unemployment 7%. They say that again today in 2 years. I think mortgage stress at 38% there. And house prices will be minus 5 or plus 5 on average. Varies, of course, by location, but that gives you a bit of a sense. That's dropped from 5% last month to 2.5%. I don't think there's much chance of that happening. The next one is what I call the best case. So this is what I think, if things went really well from here, if we get the virus under control and actually get back to work, we can probably see a 5 to 15% fall in house prices. There's probably going to be more fiscal stimulus. There's probably going to be negative interest rates or quantitative easing or, you know, whatever. It's going to be mortgage stress around 40. So that will be lower than today, of course, now. Unemployment rate 7.5% in 2 years' time. Remember, we're looking effectively ahead. 20% probability. The longer-term crunch, which is probably now the one I see most likely, has a 47.5% rating, now up from 45%, 42% of mortgage stress, unemployment rate at 8.75%, and property prices down between 15 and 30%. Again, it varies, units versus apartment, units versus houses and different locations. It's probably towards 30% in Sydney and Melbourne, probably lower in some of the other locations. And by the way, I still think Perth has got more room to go south, despite the fact that I saw today somebody's saying, oh, Perth is ready to bounce. No, I don't think it is. Now, if unfortunately the second wave really takes off and basically we get massive disruption here and around the world, then we're talking even more deep cuts with higher levels of mortgage stress, higher levels of unemployment, and home prices down 30 to 45% probably. That's still got a 25% weighting as last time. And if it's completely uncontrolled, in other words, if we can't get on top of it, then all bets are off and prices drop through the floor. But look, my view is this longer-term crunch scenario is now really out the front. And that's the one I'm basing my analysis on, based on what the data is telling me. All right, with that, hope that that's given you a bit of a flavour of what I've been looking at. And it's not good news, but you know, I'm trying to give you a bit of a sense of what I'm seeing. Other people are now calling price falls as well. And it's now becoming more a question of how much of a fall, how quickly, which all comes back to how quickly the virus will get under control or not. Will we go for elimination or just suppression? Will we be successful in maintaining the separation of the different states, or are we going to effectively find that New South Wales follows Victoria into a lockdown? And will Victoria be able to actually use lockdown to be able to suppress the virus, or will it actually continue to run? All open questions. I can't answer those, but I'm trying to give you a sense of how I think it may play out. Okay, so with that, let me just have a look at the comments and just see. Let's go with this one first. So somebody asked just now. Let's wait for it to come up. There you go. Mediocre Yuka comment said 47.5% chance of one bank bailout. Which bank would it be? I'm not going to tell you which bank it's going to be. The reason for that is that I don't think it would necessarily be fair on the individual bank concerned. But what I would say is that those banks with higher exposure to mortgages and those banks with higher exposure to investment mortgages are most likely to be the ones requiring some sort of bailout or bail-in. I think a bailout, in other words, getting more funds from the government to be able to maintain. The capital situation in our banks is not bad at the moment. You know, we have built capital up, but APRA is now basically saying you should run it down. APRA has given the banks permission to pay dividends up to 50% of earnings, which I think is a bit wacky personally. And what APRA has also said, well, you know, you can maintain loans without any repayments as in state rather than default state for a bit longer. But by January next year, you need to have worked out which ones really are. And of course, the banks are able to get very cheap funding from the Reserve Bank. So 60 basis points down is the typical funding now that the banks are getting because of the funding facility that the RBA is doing. And so what's actually happening here is that the Reserve Bank is giving really cheap money to the banks. The banks are able to then lend some of that on, but they're also able to maintain momentum in their business to be able to pay dividends. In other words, that money from the Reserve Bank is flowing directly to investors in the banks. I've got a problem with that. I think that's a really bad move, but there you go. So there you go. I'm not going to tell you which bank, but I can tell you that it's quite likely that we're going to see. I also think we're going to see the RBA buying bad mortgages down the track as well. Okay, what else have we got? Tom, thank you very much for your contribution there. I really appreciate that. Helps to keep the show going. And thanks to Alan as well for his contribution. And Javier, thank you for that. Michael Patterson says, thanks for your hard work. I hear banks are tightening lending. How tight could they get? The answer is they're actually weird at the moment. So it depends on the loan to value ratio that you have. If you've got a relatively low loan to value ratio and you've got secure income, they'll fall over themselves to lend. They're cutting rates like you wouldn't believe. A lot of people are refinancing. Whereas other people with more difficult financial situations are finding it's very difficult to move, so they're locked into these higher interest rates on existing mortgages. And the banks are still asking for a lot more information. And what I'm finding now is that I'm getting more information from individuals who've been declined by the bank because their income has been taken a hit, and they're now not inside the serviceability standards. Now, of course, the banks are being given a lot of latitude by APRA and ASIC to go round the responsible lending standards for the time being. I'm worrying about that. Using interest-only loans, I'm worrying about that. But, you know, if you are actually in a situation where you are really up against it, and the data from everywhere, not just me, is showing that there's a real issue here, then you've got to say the banks are going to be very cautious and careful. What they're doing is fighting for the meat and potato refinancing deals. Refinancing is up 40% from where it was a few months ago. And what that means is that a lot of people are being able to get cheaper rates, which of course it helps because it reduces the monthly repayments. But also bear in mind that as interest rates come down, the monthly repayments, don't drop that much. And of course, if income remains under pressure simply because of the fact that they're not getting the hours and they're not getting the jobs, and you know, maybe they had two jobs and they've only got one job now, part-time jobs in particular are at risk, this is going to create huge issues. So watch this space, but yeah, lending much tighter. There's a number of people speculating on who the bank might be. Damien Wright says, do you like gold, Martin? Well, it depends what you want gold for, I suppose. If somebody wants to give me a gold bar, yeah, I'll take it. I am a little less bullish than many on gold, and let me explain why. And look, I know that gold is nearly 2,000. I've always thought that it would go higher first. The question is, what will happen in the medium term? And there are two futures there. There are some people who believe that gold will go to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, so silver will follow. And that's because essentially we're going to be in a stagflationary environment. We're going to be in the situation where all that money that's been printed by the central banks is going to be chasing assets, and therefore gold is going to be the obvious safe haven. So that's one scenario. The other scenario, which is the one I tend to hold, is that for a time that's true, but eventually I think we're going to tip over into a deflationary environment when in fact holding gold is less important and less valuable. In fact, you know, there are a number of people, Harry Dent, of course, which I have to mention because Harry's a very big proponent of the downside scenario. I also interviewed today Steve Van Meter from, again, the US, a macro guy, who also thinks that gold could go up and then come down. There will be a chance to buy into gold later, but assuming an escalation up from this point is making certain assumptions about the way the economy is going to play out. My issue is that a lot of the stimulus that's been thrown into the system by the Fed and by other players around the world has not gone into the normal places. It's gone into the financial system. It's gone into funding indirectly corporates and buybacks and those sorts of things, about $5.5 trillion in the US. That is not inflationary necessarily directly. It's creating zombie companies because companies should be allowed to fail, but they're not. But it's not necessarily inflation. And if you don't get inflation, if your scenario is more like Japan, then gold potentially has less of a positive future. Now, I don't know which way it's going to go. And that's why I keep saying, I'm not saying one way or the other. I'm just saying, here are these two scenarios. What are the leading indicators? Well, I think the leading indicators, obviously, apart from the price currently, and there are some funnies going on between gold and silver physical prices and the prices on the exchanges, all to do with people starting to want to settle in metal rather than actually closing out some of those hybrid contracts. And a lot of those contracts, the derivative contracts, are multiple leverage onto the underlying. So John Adams was telling me that silver is 500 times leveraged into derivatives relative to the underlying. If that's true, then people are going to be wanting to make profit on the moves, right? So just be understanding that gold and silver are as much at risk of these sorts of movements as any other commodity. And bear in mind also, of course, if you hold gold or silver, you still got to convert it to something if you're going to buy something, because it's hard to buy fish and chips with a bar of gold or a piece of silver. So that's my view. I know people will say, no, you're wrong. Gold's going to go through the roof. And there are many many, many famous people who are saying gold is going to go through the roof. Might be right, might be wrong. Question is it going to be deflationary or inflationary? And that's the big unknown question. In fact, John and Adams and I did a show on this the other day, which is up on the Interests of the People channel. Okay, here's an interesting question. What are your thoughts on today's RBA keeping the cash rate unchanged? Guess it's not surprising. No, I wasn't at all surprised. Last month they did hint they might think about taking rates a little lower, but of course they've got a problem because they've pretty much said they're not going to do negative rates. I'm not sure I believe them. I think they will probably try negative rates later. But the issue is that we're at the limits of monetary policy, particularly, of course, when inflation is already well below what they target. And there's very little room for them to take rates a lot lower. Let's get rid of that. And so my point is this. The RBA is running out of steam. Bear in mind also that the CPI is way higher than the official number. Again, John and I discussed this the other day. And what the RBA has done is taken rates way too low, I think. And in fact, that route has not led to the outcomes they expected. And I know that they're going to talk about, well, we're doing all the right things and our plans have worked, etc. And we've provided liquidity into the market, etc. But inflation is not where they wanted it to be. And the interest rate is ultra low. And of course, the other thing is that when rates are so low, that puts pressure on the banks. What tends to happen is the banks then spend more time trading and in derivatives positioning to try and actually bolster income rather than actually lending to businesses or lending to households. Despite, of course, every time the Fed central banks talk about what they've done, they say about we're trying to lend to businesses and households. Here's an interesting question. How much of the liquidity that has been created in the US by the Fed has gone into real businesses and real households? $5.5 trillion. The answer is around 10%. The rest of it's gone into the financial system. And that's one of the reasons why the stock markets have gone through the roof temporarily. That is because everybody believes that the Fed will go on doing that. The question is, can they? Will they? And what happens if they try to stop? Or what happens if they don't try to stop and keep doing it? Those are the big questions. And again, look at the show I did with Steve today, because he's really on the nail here in terms of understanding some of the critical dynamics. And he made the point, of course, look, it's not really creating new money, it's just moving money from an accounting sense. So there you go. That's my best answer. It's not necessarily the one you want to hear, but that's what I think. I see that some people are asking about postcodes. I will come back to postcodes a little bit later, but I'll just do some more general questions first. Alan, thanks for your contribution. I think I've given you my sense on the silver thesis. Remember that John picked the one peak when he was saying that silver hadn't gone up over a long period of time, and it's come straight back down. I made the point. If you started from a different point, then the argument's different. Silver's probably undervalued, but there are some other views other than John's in terms of the future of silver. I'm going to leave that open. I don't know. I don't follow silver closely. What I do know is that there is nothing certain at the moment. There are too many uncertainties. And by the way, you can call that out, whether you're looking at interest rates, whether you're looking at currencies, whether you're looking at bonds, etc., etc. The financial markets are bust. They're disconnected from reality. And in fact, I was chatting to George Gammon today. I actually recorded a show for his channel, which I think will be up in a couple of days. I'll let you know when it's there. And we were talking about some of these issues too, because George's view is that the Fed is really, they've lost the plot. And I tend to think that he's right. Okay, what else have we got in terms of... Let's put this one up. Apologies for the language. Aaron Black says Perth is long-term screwed, one industry town. Yeah, the interesting thing about Perth, I mean, I've been following Perth for a long time. Property prices in Perth have been dropping since 2012-13. And every few weeks, the real estate sector say, it's on the turn, it's on the turn, it's on the turn. And every time if they say it's on the turn, it's on the turn, I say, well, I haven't seen it yet. Now, there was a spike in purchases of land and building packages because of the stimulus package that was a combination of the building incentive from federal and also the state incentive. You could get $55,000 to go buy a home land building package. And they had a massive spike up in terms of demand. But of course, we've really got a lot of supply over in Perth. Net migration is down. And there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that really Perth's economy is on the turn and prices are going to turn up. Now, in some locations close into centre of Perth, maybe prices will stabilise and come back. But a lot of the areas I look at, which is north and south of central Perth, we're considering still seeing considerable falls, and there was a drop of more than 2% in the last quarter. So that's what I think. We've just got 1,040, so thank you very much. We've made the 1,000 tonight. Really appreciate your being on and spreading the word. That's great. Well, that's quite a funny comment. One Burgess said, "This point Blockbuster Video looks like the safest investment." Yeah, it is a problem. I mean, you know, safe investment? It's hard to know. Really hard to know at the moment. The fact of the matter is that we are in uncharted territory. You've got to assume that property prices will continue to drift lower. And in some cases, as I proved in my recent presentation, prices are way, way down from where they are in some locations. And I've got a lot of data. I'm not going to share it tonight. There's too many other things to talk about on the show. But the fact is that there are a lot of examples of prices that have been recently settled much lower than where they were previously. And I've did a presentation the other day and I showed you some examples of that. We'll do more of that. Cookie Boy's been looking at some more data and I'll share that shortly. The reason that's important is that a couple of things. One is a lot of prices are not being disclosed when they're sold at the moment. And when you ask an agent why that's the case, it's often they're coy about the price because it's lower than they expected it would be. So it takes 2 months for that price to flow back into any of the official statistics. And yet, that information, despite the fact that it's not publicly available, will tend to be overstated in some of the indices, right? So that's why some of the indices are not actually giving us a very good read on what's going on at the moment. The second point is that the more you look at this, you start to see patterns. So you start to see particular locations and groups of postcodes where the same thing is happening, which is, in other words, people are selling out. The reason they're selling out is because they bought, let's say, 2012, 2013, they're sitting on equity. And what they're now doing is getting some of that equity out and taking the money and running. Of course, the question I ask is, what are you doing with it? Where are you going to put it? You know, are you going to put it in bonds? Are you going to put it in the stock market? Stock market's very high at the moment, very toppy. Bonds, well, maybe not. A lot of people are putting money in bonds at the moment because of they're more secure. Some people are buying gold, silver. Some people are going into Bitcoin, all those things. It's really tough to know what to do with money. My own perspective has been for some time, stay liquid, hold on, see what happens, because there are so many uncertainties, but other people will do different things. But no, it's a big question. It really is a big question. Okay, what else have we got? John Adams, have you heard of me? I've been banging the drum for 4 years. Yes, indeed you have. Indeed. Too much debt. All right, now I've got a few postcodes. I might just do a couple of postcodes. I don't necessarily want to do too many tonight, but there's a few people asking me for postcode data. I guess that's a good thing. And you might like to know that I've provided more than 600 individual contacts, 600 in the last 3 weeks with postcode data. 600. I tell you what, it's a full-time job. So if you get the data and not a lot else from me when you ask for the information, that's the reason I'm getting lots and lots of requests. And, it's a little bit tough. It really is a little bit tough to try and deal with this. So let me just pick one. 307, two was one that somebody asked me earlier on, and this will introduce those who are not familiar with it to my postcode database. So this is the point about this database is this linked directly to my core market model. And the core market model is, as I said earlier on, the core tool that I use to be able to analyze what's going on. Now, here is the data for 3072. And let me just talk you through it, because this is the standard set of data that I always show. So this is actually Preston in Victoria, and it includes Regent's West, Preston South, Preston and Northland Centre. It's in the outer suburbs of Victoria. And I classify it partly also by my segment. So this is the predominant household segment there. And there are 14,251 households in that postcode. Around 4,500 are borrowing. Around 7,288 are renting. There are around 5,581 properties for rent. And the number of rental property owners living in that postcode is 3,970. Now, of those who are borrowing, 3,055 are in mild stress. There are no in severe stress. So mild stress means that people are struggling but keeping their head just above water. Severe stress means they've got big issues. But that means that 66.7% of households in this postcode are now struggling from cash flow issues. Now, anything above about 30% is a warning. So this is double that. So this suggests to me that prices will slide from this point. We've also got default risk at 2.1% or 95 over the next year or so. And we've got 1,848 in rental stress, so at 25%. 25% is not too bad, remembering that 34% was the average across the country. And we've got some investor stress, 16%, but not a lot. So that's the story there. Rental stress, not too bad. Investor stress, not too bad. But mortgage stress is the issue. And we see this again and again and again in these outer suburban areas where effectively people are in over their heads. And now, essentially, everything else is looking pretty pear-shaped. So there you go. That's the first postcode of the night. I will do some more as we progress this evening, but I thought you might enjoy that one. Here's an interesting comment from the new voice. Thank you for that. I've also worked out that the actual annual increase in postcode 3000 over the past 9 years has been 1.13%. That's far off the 8% gains the media talks about. Hear, hear. Well, you know, I did a show the other day where I basically pulled apart Brisbane and said, you know, they're talking about massive price rises. No, it's not the right story, I'm afraid. I think your analysis is much closer. And I'm seeing this again, that there will be a lot of significant issues with regard to the way that prices are going to run. I don't think there's a lot of growth. And remember, of course, if you adjust for inflation, inflation adjusted, it's even worse. And, of course, nobody remembers that inflation's been running higher than 1.3% for quite some time. So I agree with you. Thank you for that. And Damien asked an interesting question. China. Do you think China will be our great hope for economic recovery this time? Tough to see. I mean, as well as the political environment that's different this time, and of course, you know, Australia's sitting on the fence between China and the US, and in fact, next week, there'll be the great China debate. So I've got Robbie Barwick coming on and Salvatore Bobones, basically to discuss China and some of the issues around just this question. So we'll have a bigger discussion there. Plexus will be pretty busy on the moderating, I suspect, next week, where we go. But so the first point is the political environment is different, but the other one is what China's doing. So China is stimulating, and China is trying to get momentum back. They're doing it by cutting capital ratios for the banks. They're getting the banks to lend more. They're trying to get people to pull money back into China and invest it in China. They're doing a lot of infrastructure builds in China, which may actually be positive for steel. And indeed, the trade data today showed there was a significant fall in imports, but the fall in exports was a lot lower. So, in fact, the net trade balance was higher, a lot driven by very high iron ore prices. So that's going to support us in the short term. But my own perspective is it's going to be hard to see how this time around we're going to be able to rely on China like we did post the global financial crisis. The reason we got out of jail from the global financial crisis was China, and also the fact that some of our banks got bailed out by the Fed. interesting question somebody asked me earlier on. Is it likely that the Fed is going to bail out our banks if they need it? The world has changed. And again, you've got Trump there who's, you know, keeping the US great, not interested so much in the international situation. We do have those swap lines that are available, but those swap lines are more to the benefit of the US than ourselves. So my own feeling is that the ability to support our banks from overseas markets is lower. One reason I think why the bank here in Australia, the RBA, has created these cheap funding lines to support the banks. So the banks at the moment can get as much liquidity as they need. So I don't think China is going to be our get-out-of-jail card. And by the way, neither is India. And again, I discussed that the other day with Salvatore, where we spoke about some of the differences between India and China and the fact that the Indian economy is not going to provide the same opportunities as China. We've really narrowed ourselves into a corner with this massive relationship with China and this trade thing. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I think that ahead we need to actually think more about building activity here in Australia. I keep talking about innovation. I keep talking about creating more momentum here rather than just exporting more and hoping that that'll work. The house and hold story of Australia, I think, is coming to an end. And at the moment, we don't really have a plan B. And in fact, I will just go back to that one. So Cooper Tripper asked, do you think Australia was bailed out by the Fed in the GFC? Yes, it was. So a couple of the major banks here got to help from the Fed. And as a result, are we obliged to expand our loan book, create RBS to repay the favour? I'm not sure that's going to be the way it's going to be. The Fed in the US basically says they've got unlimited capacity to do things and they will do whatever it takes. So you sort of take that on trust. I mean, a lot of it's confidence, right? So at the moment, the Fed is basically, you know, talking it up and saying we're not even going to think about rates rises, right? So that sort of signals long rates, low rates for a long period of time. I'm not sure that we've got much ability to be able to support the US. More the question is, would the US support us in a downturn? Remembering, of course, that this economic scenario that we're looking at, which is depression territory now, not just recession territory, but depression territory, is global in nature. And this is a, you know, 1-in-100-year event that we're watching. This is an economic scenario that is as bad as you can think it could be. And I just don't think we're going to find that the Fed is going to bail us out either. So that's my view there. Interesting question here. Trimmer said, saw that business loan deferrals were 70%. Could this impact housing as many business loans are secured? Probably spot on there. Good point. Yes, absolutely. So in my other survey, not the household survey, but my business survey, I'm seeing this already. So a lot of people, small businesses, were forced to put their house on the line to get finance. And now, of course, they're struggling with their business. So about 1 in 3 businesses are struggling in my data at the moment. And a significant proportion of those actually have property to buttress their facilities. And the banks are not being very generous. Now, there was this $40 billion stimulus support for business that was announced. About 1.5 billion was actually made, so a lot of businesses never went close to it. And what that means is we've got lots of businesses really struggling. And by the way, only a small proportion of businesses went for the JobKeeper route because they couldn't justify all of the momentum. So if you don't go JobKeeper and you don't go JobSeeker, then, you know, the business is going to fold. And the worry I now have, particularly in Victoria, is we're going to see lots of businesses shutting up and simply saying, we can't do this anymore. Now, there are, of course, temporary rules with regard to directors' responsibilities and trading insolvent, you know, which will help in the short term, but that can't go on forever. This is going to come home to roost. And I personally have always argued that the mortgage sector is looking very sick, as I showed in my data, but it's this business sector that's going to be where the real impost comes first. And if you look in the US, post-global financial crisis, it took 3 or 4 years for the mortgage bomb to really explode and prices, home prices drop and defaults rise. It was the business sector, not the large corporates, but further down, it was the business sector that went off first. And I think we're going to see the same. So 6 to 12 months from now, I think we're going to see the number of businesses in existence down quite a lot. We're going to see many more defaulting. And as a result of that, we're going to see quite a few houses on the market from the business sector. Okay, John is... I was just with Martin. Things are very short certain. Let's see who's correct. Well, we'll know. We'll know soon. We'll know soon enough, John. I agree. I just think there are too many other variables, but you and I will not disagree on everything. That's fine. Okay, this is one. Do you think the government deliberately crashed the already failing economy with this virus being a cover? Well, I'm not sure I'd typify it like that, but let's be clear about two things. Firstly, there was already massive evidence of too much debt in the system, the economy already tanking, unemployment rising, and things looking pretty awkward, right? That was before the virus landed. Then the virus hit. And so, in a way, the virus has become an alibi and a justification for things that they would probably not otherwise do. But I come back to the fact that the virus has catalysed something that was already happening. It's not created a completely new environment here in Australia. The debt bomb was already going off. We already knew that. John said he'd been saying about it for four years or something. I've been saying something similar. This is not totally new. And so as a result of that, the likelihood is that this was always going to be a problem. The politicians are always keen to find plausible deniability. In other words, blame somebody else. And so they can blame the virus, which is one of the reasons why I think that the virus is now centre stage. And I'm not downplaying the significance of the illness. I've actually lost two people who are quite close to me from the UK because of the virus. Neither of them were above 70. Both of them were quite a lot younger than that. So they weren't old, and this can be deadly. But the fact is that putting everything into the virus basket, as it were, and saying, well, look at everything through the virus lens, I think is probably a bit of a mistake, personally. There has to be some balance in this conversation, because the economy, of course, is now looking pretty sick. And like I said, the problem is that unemployment, which is high, will take a long time to come back, even now. So typically you go down the escalator when unemployment rises, but you have to climb up the stairs, and those stairs can take 3, 4, 5 years. So it's going to be a long, slow haul before we get back to anything like where we were. And where we were wasn't particularly wonderful. I hope that we find a new path, and we actually, you know, think about doing things differently, not just doing the same old, but when Josh Frydenberg says, you know, Reagan and Thatcher had the right ideas, I'm thinking, oh no, you know, I can't believe it. I can't believe that they would actually go down and believe that that's the right answer. We need a new way of thinking about innovation and creativity and investing in local businesses and, you know, enabling growth from a different quarter, because growing purely off inflated housing, growing purely off strong migration. So our QE for the last few years has been very much bringing people into the country, right? GDP per capita has been much lower. And what that basically means is, if we just go back to that, we're going to end up with a complete mess. We need a different strategy. Unfortunately, I don't think the incumbents are capable of thinking beyond their current parameters. And unfortunately, I'm not that optimistic, but I'm hopeful, and I will continue to push strongly as I can for a different way of thinking. All right. Here's an interesting question from Nicholas Hughes. What are your thoughts about rural property and farms in Australia? Are we seeing Australian farmers facing mortgage stress? I do actually have data on rural, and the stress there, though, is predominantly from the drought and from the fact that many farms have been under huge pressure for many years. There were, of course, relief packages that were released earlier on. Some of those are still in situ. Somebody was telling me that they're seeing some land prices holding up, and in fact, relative to price movements in the cities and in the urban fringes, some people are suggesting that land in the rural areas may well hold up more. I'm not necessarily sure I'm totally convinced by that either. But we are definitely seeing a number of farming communities absolutely up against it. Combination of drought, bushfire, and then, of course, COVID over the top. So all of those things together. So it's very, very, very unfortunate what's going on there. It's an interesting comment from New Zealand. Nothing is moving up or down here in New Zealand. Do you think we'll have the same scenario as Australia? When you say moving up and down, I assume you mean property prices. I'm not sure that I'd necessarily totally agree with that analysis of New Zealand. We're going to do some more analysis of New Zealand soon. Good news that Joe Wilkes is coming back on. I spoke with him today. He's had a few issues to deal with over the last few months, but he's back now, and we'll be recording a show next week, and we'll be starting to do a series on New Zealand, and we'll look at that in more detail. I think you've got to look granularly. I think there are movements up and movements down. So, for example, I know on the South Island, there have been quite significant property price movements down relatively recently. In other places, slightly more up. We also, I think, a bit suspicious about some of the statistics that are being thrown around in New Zealand. Heard that before, of course. So there's a big question mark in my mind about what's really going on over there. Obviously, New Zealand has managed to suppress, maybe even eliminate the virus. So in a way, there's a chance of getting back to a more normal environment. But of course, internationally, the borders are still shut. So you're not going to have an economy that was firing like it used to be. And of course, migration is going to stay very slow and very low. And I saw some statistics quite recently from New Zealand that in fact, migration net was going out rather than coming in. So you'd wonder whether in fact there is enough demand to support prices. I know interest rates are very low. There's a lot of property that's listed in New Zealand as for sale that's actually new construction or being constructed or will be constructed. So that's where a lot of the growth is coming from. And that's not necessarily productive as well. So, you know, I'm not sure. We'll cover New Zealand in more detail in another show later on. Okay, let me see what else is coming on. So this is one from Adita. Can banks keep on extending the interest-only period for years till we get back to pre-pandemic employment to avoid defaults with APRA's confidence? Well, that's a really interesting question. So APRA has said you've got 6 months and then you've got 4 months. And then that 4 months, each bank has to go through and look at each borrower who's actually on a repayment holiday to effectively see whether they're going to revert to normal. If not, then they need a workout plan, and that workout plan presumably means selling the property, right? Now, APRA has not precisely said what's going to happen at the end of that period. Could well be that they end up then saying, okay, we'll kick it on a bit. But there has to be a reckoning point, right? At what point is a loan a bad loan? That's the key question, right? And sure, they can change the definition and say the bad loan isn't a bad loan because we've basically said it's not a bad loan. The question is, will the market buy that? If the market doesn't buy that, it's irrelevant anyway. And of course, the thing about a loan being classified as a bad loan is it then takes more capital. So it costs the banks a lot more to hold it, which means that they then actually are more likely to try and foreclose and get rid of it. But what the banks are trying to do at the moment is use that 4 months to encourage people to sell. So there's a lot of conversations that I've had with people who've been approached by the bank, and there's a conversation going on about, we think you should sell, you know, our recommendation is you should sell. You know, they're not saying you must sell, but they're saying, think it, you should sell. So one of the reasons why I think listings are going to go up later in the year is because more of this is going to work through. Remember what I gave you earlier on with all those statistics in terms of the proportion of loans that are actually deferred at the moment? It's a big deal. I don't think APRA can keep that going on forever, but APRA only makes decisions to support the banks, of course. APRA is not doing its job in terms of financial stability from a consumer perspective, in my view. And APRA will argue that financial stability means protecting the banks at all costs. I have a problem with that personally, but that's probably what they'll do. Very interesting question here from a decaying one. In a world with a high Aussie dollar relative to US dollar, wouldn't the Australian government want to personally lower it to facilitate international trade? Yep, you're right. The Reserve Bank would prefer the dollar to be at 50 to 55 rather than 72 to 75. Two reasons. One is it improves our terms of trade. And secondly, it allows us to import inflation into Australia. And of course, the bank is still struggling with inflation. Now, whether inflation targeting is something that should be there is another interesting question. My own perspective on that is it's a dumb strategy. It was okay when inflation was raging at 12, 15% to get it down. But in a low inflation environment, targeting inflation probably doesn't make a lot of sense. But still, they're going to do it. They go on doing it anyway. So the point of there is that it's hard to know how to pull that lever down, right? So if the confidence starts decaying in the Australian economy, then you could see the currency fall. And, you know, a number of people have said for quite some time, at some point, if in fact we have a deteriorating economy, that will be when the Aussie dollar drops. But of course, at the moment, the reason the Aussie dollar is high is because the US dollar has actually slipped relative to where it was previously. So it's partly a relativity to the US. And of course, the US is still struggling with COVID, et cetera, et cetera. So all of those factors there. I think it's going to be quite difficult to see how the Aussie dollar is going to get back down to 55 at the moment, which is going to put huge pressure on the terms of trade. And it's going to make things much more complicated for us here. That's my perspective at the moment. Javier, I think I've probably answered that question too. Am I bullish on the US dollar short to medium term? Yeah, I think the Fed still thinks they've got plenty of firepower. And my perspective is that I want to keep the US dollar high up to the election. I think the election's a big thing to worry about or think about. What happens if Trump gets in, or what happens if Biden gets in? That could change things a little bit. Lots of unknowns, of course. The virus is still raging in the US. The economy is looking weaker than previously. The unemployment number has gone higher again. There are more zombie companies in the US than previously. So there are lots of reasons to worry about the US. But on the other hand, they do have a lot of firepower. And I suspect the Fed will be able to keep throwing that around for some time. And you know, don't, as some people often say, don't bet against the Fed. In a way, we've moved away from you know, a standard you know, commercial environment, I think. You know, call it capitalism or call it market economy. I call it a market economy. It's not a market economy anymore. It's been interfered with by the Fed dramatically. And therefore, whatever we have now is some sort of hybrid of a market economy and a centralist intervention and centralist control. That's the truth. And therefore, it's hard to know quite how this is going to play out with the dollar. And of course, the other question is, what happens relatively to other currencies, right? Because if, in fact, other places around the world gets into even more difficulty, I'm thinking the UK, Brexit, I'm thinking of the Eurozone looking pretty bad. Japan's looking pretty bad as well. You could still see some strength in the US dollar. And, you know, the US dollar is still seen as a reserve currency at the moment. There's a big debate whether that will stay that way. There are some people saying there will be a replacement eventually. But in the short term, I think the US dollar is likely to hold out. Okay, let's have a look, see what else we've got. So D says, thank you for your contribution, D. All the printing in the works and probably more to come, is cash still the king? Well, I think so. I've held that view for some time. Others will disagree. I've kept liquid, and the reason I've kept liquid is because I can't tell yet how this is all going to play out. And, you know, the main thing for me is not getting locked into things that would be hard to unwind if things went one way or the other. So yeah, I'm tending to be a little bit more liquid than some. Okay, now Dimantra Beats, thank you for that. First home buyer here from the Surf Coast in Victoria. Are property prices unlikely to fall here because of location? The code is 3226. Well, let's just put the code in and have a quick look at that, eh? 3226. We'll see what that is. Apply. It's running it now. Okay, Ocean Grove. 3226. Okay. So 7,300 households, 2,600 borrowing, 3,400 renting, 2,600 properties for rent, 1,800 and something property renters, mild stress, some mild stress, 1,103, 42.3%. default rate, quite high, 3.5%, that's a worry. Rental stress, 41%. Investor stress, 36%. Okay, put those together. There are definitely down forces here that would suggest that prices are unlikely to move significantly higher from this point. Basically, anything above 30% on any of those metrics, and when they actually accumulate like you've got there, would suggest to me that there are definitely some risks attached. You're right about the location. And, you know, generally, locations like on the ocean and those sorts of things tend to have greater resilience relative to others. But these numbers don't lie. And I will just add that I'm building another module in my system here to be able to start reporting my projections of home prices based on the analysis coming out of the core model. So it's not ready yet, but once that's there, I'll start sharing that as well, because I think that's now becoming quite an important discussion. So I think probably sideways or down slightly rather than significantly up is my read on that at the moment. Could be wrong, but that's my analysis. John Cheeseman, thanks for that. Love your show. Just heard from a friend of a friend who's bought a house. So there is someone out there buying. Yeah, no, there are people buying. The question is, what are they buying and how much are they paying, right? That's the key question. And I've shown you some quite a lot of data recently. So a lot of people are buying, but they're paying less than they were previously. Some people are buying because they want to have a long-term hold and they're going to live there and it's going to be a property for predominantly you know, residential purposes rather than investment purposes, and therefore the capital gain question, which has gone away, I think, for quite some time, in my view, is less relevant. There's going to be very little capital gain in property in the next few years. And just to be clear, we've had a unique situation over the last 20 years with deregulation, migration, the banks lending to billio, and that's pushed prices much higher than they should have gone up. But if you look long term over the last 150 years or so, prices have not gone up like that. My belief is that we're not going to see that same growth from this point. So if you buy now, you buy because you want to live there. It's a lifestyle choice. It's something you're going to hold for 5, 10, 15 years. You might get a little bit of growth over that time. You might not. But if you're a property investor and you think you're buying now and you're expecting capital growth in the next 6 to 12 months, forget it. In the next 2 to 3 years, forget it. If you're buying off the plan, dumb strategy at the moment, because people are actually discounting somewhat, but they're still very high relative to what their value is. And there are thousands and thousands of thousands, particularly of high-rise properties coming onto the market. More will come on the market. The high-rise sector in and around our manufacturing centres is going through the floor and will continue through the floor. So my view is the property investing is not worth thinking about at the moment. But if you're buying for long-term hold, to live, you know, basically as a place of residence and security, if you get a good price, it might still be worth it. Okay, what else have we got? This is from Matthew. He says, what have you done to manage your risk personally? What's your spread given percentages? What would your position be? Open debate with people who share a different view. Okay, well, I think I've explained before. I've gone liquid. I went liquid 18 months or so ago. I missed a little bit of the upside, but that's okay. Because what I wanted to do, and I've basically spread those risks by holding deposits in a number of different banks below the 250k limit. That's to do with the deposit insurance, which might be activated by the government if, in fact, there was a problem. I've been quite selective in where I've put the money in. I haven't necessarily gone with the big four. I've gone with some of the smaller organisations, those that actually are a little bit more protected in my view, because they hold lower risk ratios, less derivatives exposures. So I've done that firstly. I've also got some stocks. So I've been in the stock market for quite some time. I've tended to buy low and, you know, hold. I've ridden it up, ridden it down, ridden it up. I'm looking at the moment potentially to cash some of those out quite soon, because I think we're probably at the next peak, but I'll probably wait just a little bit longer before I do that. I've been, again, selective, and I've spread my risks across multiple sectors. So that's pretty much what I've done. I don't hold gold. I don't hold silver, because I can't really price it effectively, and I think there are too many externalities. Bitcoin is not something I'm regarding as an investment. I think that's a speculation, so I don't do that. And I, you know, have a property because that's where I live. So that's what I've done. So now there will be people with very different views. And if you have a different view of the future, and, you know, you're going to take different steps. There's no right answer. I can only tell you what I've done. But I like the flexibility of what I have at the moment. And I will play ahead depending on how I think things are going to develop over the next 2 to 3 years. Now, there are other people who have completely different views, who think they're out of the banking system, they're holding, you know, metals, and they think that's the future, and that's fine. You've got to make a decision, you know, where you think it's going to be. There's no right answer. You won't know until the future, and, you know, by then it'll be too late. So that's just reality, I'm afraid. But anyway, that's what I've done. Okay, what else have we got? Somebody's coming there, coming and said, Nico's saying, I'm waiting for a bargain on the Gold Coast. Well, there are some gut bargains. I've been noticing at the moment a lot of distressed sales there happening, particularly for investment properties in some of those high rises. So I think you're going to see a lot more bargains. They're still building, of course, up there as well. So, and Pencil Pusher said, name the safe banks. No, I'm not going to do that because, you know, it's hard to get data in Australia about what the banks are really like. You can look at their results and you can look at their information sets published in the annual accounts. It doesn't tell you how really that much. The questions that I ask is, what's their exposure to derivatives? What's their ratio of funding from deposits relative to bonds and other categories? And what's their risk profile? So I tend to go for smaller organisations, some credit unions, that actually are more conservatively run. They're not necessarily run for profit. They're run for the benefit of the members. And so I tend to go there rather than some of the big guys who've got these huge derivatives exposures. They've got massively complex businesses who they don't really necessarily understand the full risks, disclose the risks. But I'm not going to give names of individual organisations. I should say New Zealand, where, of course, deposit bail-in is clearly on the table. The Reserve Bank in New Zealand has created a whole dashboard of information for every bank in New Zealand, so people can go and look at it and make relativity choices about the risk profiles. We don't have that in Australia. APRA doesn't do that. They keep saying they were going to do some more specific disclosure. They never did it. So our banking system is not designed to be transparent. It's not designed to be open. It's not designed to help you make risk related decisions in terms of where you put your money. That's a problem. One of the reasons why we're battling with this bail-in legislation, which of course is in the Senate at the moment, is to clearly take deposits off the table, because there's even a risk of deposits being bailed in potentially. Not a high risk perhaps at the moment, but there is a bit of a risk there. So yeah, it's a trade-off. There's no such thing as a safe investment. Really, there isn't. Even if you hold cash, even if you hold notes in your hand, right, you've got to hold those notes physically and keep them safe. That's not necessarily 100% safe. There is no 100% safe option at the moment, unfortunately. And some people will decide to go for a property even now because, you know, bricks and mortar, well, bricks and mortar stays bricks and mortar. It's just that values might drop. Okay. 1,129, says Plexus. That's pretty good, isn't it? Not quite as good as Edwin the other day, but thank you very much for spending some time with me. It's really good. Now, where are we? 9:25. Oh, gosh. Okay. We're running out of time yet again. I have hardly answered any questions. I apologize. I've got thousands and thousands in the queue there. But, you know, there's only... okay. My Gregory Anvil has just asked about Mandurah. So I mentioned Mandurah earlier on. So prices are 38% down. Huge social issues in Mandurah with, you know, drugs on the streets and things like that. A lot of stressed property investors are still trying to sell and trying to get out. There are pretty difficult stories. And, you know, if you drive in and around the area, lots of property still for sale. So it hasn't shaken out. And I keep saying, I don't want to pick on Mandurah, but I'm picking some of those early 4 or 5 years ago, the indicators in terms of mortgage stress were there in Mandurah. And we're seeing precisely the same issues again now. So, you know, I think we could definitely see similar things as we saw in Mandurah in other places, unfortunately. I think it's worth going back to Tony LeCantro and listening to some of the stuff that he talks about, because, you know, he talks a lot of sense in terms of the social consequences. Or indeed, I interviewed somebody from Ireland some time ago who spoke about the social consequences of debt and housing falls and unemployment, all of those things that we're now seeing in spades. I mean, this is a social issue. It's not just a financial issue. And these social issues have huge and terrible consequences on families and individuals and on communities. And that's what I'm worried about. That's why I think the government is really not stepping up sufficiently, I'm afraid, at this stage. All right, let me just go back to the next part of my presentation. Just a few more points I want to make. And the first thing I'm going to talk about, just briefly, is I'm going to introduce a new service. And I've called it a DFA 1-to-1. And the reason I've done that is because I'm getting a lot of people wanting to chat to me about a particular location. And I can share some information through my postcode data set and send it across. But people want more than that. So here is now an individual opportunity for you to have a discussion with me one-on-one, okay, around a particular postcode. I can't give specific financial advice, but I can discuss my analysis for a given postcode, and I can look at the underlying trends in terms of prices and those sorts of things. I can assemble stress data, home price trend data, and extract a view of the price trends ahead based on my modelling. So that's essentially what I have accessible. Now, to make this work, you're now going to want, if you want to do this, you're going to need to book a time with me for a Zoom or a phone discussion. It can be up to an hour in length. And I'm going to say that that's going to be available for $100 plus GST payable in advance. And if, in fact, you want to pursue that, then contact me via my blog. The space is going to be limited on this. I'm going to do a few a week, so it may not be able to be done immediately. But I'm trying to give an alternative and a more detailed personalized service, because I believe that there is a real need at the moment for that. So that's the DFA one-on-one service, which is now officially launched. Go across to the DFA blog, and if you want the information on the DFA blog, it's digitalfinanceanalytics.com/blog, and down there you'll see there's a little dialogue bottom right hand side where you can actually send me a message directly, and then I'll get back to you and then we can sort something out. So that's just a new service that I'm launching today. I'm also continuing our Patreon program, and we've got a number of new people, thanks for those who signed up, to get access to my stress data. So for $50 a month plus GST, that's US dollars, not Aussie dollars. The other one was Aussie dollars. This is US dollars. You can actually get my full listing. And for those who signed up, I will be sending out the July data in the next 48 hours. So look for your inbox. That should arrive. There are various tier levels. The $3 for supporting us, $10, $25 gets more access to more content. And if you really want my data, the full data set for a month, you can also access that through the $500 a month series. But the DFA stress data at $50 GST, plus GST US dollars, is proving very popular. And if that gives you the breakdown of data that I displayed for a few postcodes, for every postcode in the country every month. And so people find that quite useful. Or if you want to support me just directly, you can do it via PayPal. Details below there. We do have some people who do that, and thank you for that. Every little help that we get goes right back into making more content. We don't make any profit out of DFA. This is simply continuing just to support the business and enabling us to make more great content. We've produced a lot of material over the last few weeks, particularly on property. We're going to have a lot more to say about property ahead. And, you know, if you feel more you want to support us, we'd be fantastic. Or if you want Bitcoin, we even still do Bitcoin. Not many people have stepped up for that, but, you know, it is there. Now, we also have merch. I won't spend much time on that. Again, just to say, you can get a DFA mug or a DFA sticker or what have you. Some people have done that. So that's another way of just helping us to fund ourselves. In terms of recent top hits, the one with Steve Van Meter today, worth a watch. That's really on gold, on the US and what the Fed's doing. Stagflation, occurring before your very eyes. That's the one with John Adams and myself, where we discuss CPI, inflation, stagflation. John explained why he thinks gold is the and silver is the way to go. The property spoofing continues. That was one of my shows. And the property story from soup to nuts. That's where I decoded the property sector and really spoke in, I think, quite heated terms about what's going on in the property market. I'm so frustrated with all this spruiking that's out there. I'm trying to give an alternative and a more balanced narrative. And also look at the George Gammon show that we did last week, where we said, is economics, is it broken? The answer is yep. And he was very vociferous on that. Okay, next week, the show is the great debate. The great China debate. I actually wanted to say the great debate of China, but I could not work it out. It's the great debate on China. And that will be with Robbie Barwick and with Salvatore Babanz. A very interesting debate, different perspectives on China. I'll also be making a few points too. Very critical conversation about trying to understand a bit more about China and different people's perspectives. And with that, it's 9:33, and so I've basically come to the end of runway again. I will just have a quick last look. A lot of conversations there about property. Cookie Boy says never miss a payment. I agree with that. Okay. I think that's pretty much it. Do I accept old-fashioned cash? You can make a direct transfer to me. I can give by via PayID if you want to take me up on that offer. So if somebody reaches out to say I'd like to take advantage of that one-on-one offer, I then send information back. We agree a time and a channel, and then I basically give various payment options. Once that payment is received, then we can go ahead and do it. I need a little bit of time to do the research because I have to pull data out, price data, trend data, stress data out of the model, all of that. But that's the way it's going. We'll be back, of course, in 2 weeks' time with our next post, specifically on confidence. And we'll do some of the mapping from some of this data that I've shared with you today. And we'll update the scenarios once again. And then the following week, there'll be another live show. I'll talk more about that next time. Now, if you want just postcode information, postcode for one postcode, or maybe two if you really must, you can also send me a message via the DFA blog. And if you do that, I will get that information back to you. As I explained, I had 500 in the last 3 weeks, so it might take a day or two, but it is quite feasible for you to get the postcode data. It doesn't cost you anything. If you want to make a donation, fine, but you don't have to. But that's also available now. Okay, so I just want to say, Nifi, thanks very much for that contribution. Thank you very much for all of those who made specific contributions through the Smart Chat. And thank you for your time tonight. The peak concurrent, I think, I just want to have a quick look, got to 1,131. So thank you very much. Tremendous to have so many people on. I look forward to seeing you next week, or if China doesn't take your fancy, the week after. We'll be back, of course. Do keep watching DFA. Do keep watching Interest of the People as well. There's a lot of material over there, which is also worthwhile watching. And if you have specific questions that you want to address, you can again contact me via the DFA blog. So thank you very much for your time today. I want to wish you a safe time at the moment, particularly those down in Melbourne. Keep safe, keep secure, and I look forward to seeing you again next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Take care.